Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As I got to the slip cord, everyone's just gone, "You are what?" And I turn around and I say, "He's not giving him out. He's not giving him out." It was such a disbelief.
You're listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast with me, Will Rowe. These are the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. In this podcast, Alan Donald relives his second tour to England in 1998. But before that, we chat about the backdrop to his sporting career. During the 80s and early 90s, as Alan makes his way as a professional cricketer, politics and sport come head to head. Nations boycott South Africa over the political system of apartheid. But there were tours to the country, as cricket teams would, controversially, defy their governing bodies with rebel sides. The last of these came in 1990, an unofficial England team led by Mike Gatting. So, could you divide sport and politics?
Not at that stage, no. No, it was always going to be, and I just felt that, you know, back then you had the 64 guys or 66, or the Graham Pollock only played 6 test matches. Same with Mike Proctor. They played over here in England before they finally got "that's enough." But yeah, it was very much, you could feel that the politics was way too much, and the pressure became way too much. And I mean, if you go back a few years before, when Gatting's team came out to South Africa, that is the most scared I got, because that tour for me was never ever should have taken place. It was an England team that got asked to come over, and the timing was hopelessly wrong.
Were you physically scared?
Yeah, because we were refused. They didn't serve us in hotels. The point was absolutely made in our faces that this is no longer going to happen. And Mike Gatting walked out, I believe it was in Pietermaritzburg, and he walked out to see this group of people, and someone threw something from the crowd and luckily hit a security guard and a security guy next to him. I mean, I actually felt more frightened for him, because what are they going to do? You know, is that these people are, they wanted to obviously hand over a memorandum to say what you're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
And it was wrong. And Gatting's team couldn't play cricket. I think they just, their one eye was what's happening outside of the ground. And they just couldn't focus. But the tour should never have happened. It was just not in my book. I found that was wrong, making the wrong statement. Politics was in our faces, and we grew up with that. Now, as we go into this, the more we became closer as a nation.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that was what was happening. The people at home were starved of international sport, and now they want to succeed, be associated and being proud of a team that's winning. You know, whether it's the Springboks or whether it's the Proteas playing cricket or any other sport for that matter, but or football. So, but now we're starting to produce the goods, and we're starting to, you know, that was the start of the Rainbow Nation that everyone talks about.
So, yeah, 94 is, you've gone from what you just described, the bad side of the politics and sports being intertwined. But then you come to 1994 and you have the new South Africa, and then suddenly you see the power of sport and the good that it can do. And it kind of struck me, reading your autobiography, White Lightning, doing this podcast series, I've read various cricketing autobiographies. Most people have a foreword from a legend of the game, a former player. You have a foreword from one of the greatest statesmen that's ever walked this planet, Nelson Mandela. That's quite special.
Yeah. Well, when we played India in our first series at home, we met Mr. Mandela at the Wanderers, and he came and shook our hands at lunchtime. And we all lined up, the Indian guys were all lined up next to us. And he got to me. And all he could say was, "Ah, Mr. Donald, how is the Free State?" And I thought, "You're not supposed to know where I live, you know, but you are Mr. Mandela. Are you seriously kidding me?" I mean, I said, "No, the Free State is fantastic, Mr. President. It was really," he said, because the ANC, that's where their base is anyway. But yeah. Also, he knew about us. He knew what was happening. He knew what was Hansi Cronje, what his role was. He knew what my role was. And he just said, "Listen, good luck in the second innings. We'll be watching." You know, that, you know, and for us to have gone to him to write the foreword for that book was as only I knew he could. And he did that. He gladly did that. And I've got a copy at home where he personally signed that book. So it was, he was an unbelievable man. Just his calmness and his the way he kept a nation so close and so inspired all the time. You know, it was to have him do that for me was incredible, really incredible.
So in 1998, South Africa are back in England. Most of us remember Donald v. Atherton that summer. We'll come on to that. But the first test of the series ends in a rain-affected draw at Edgbaston. South Africa a little lucky, as England were in a strong position. It's Lords next, and as in 1994, Alan enjoys success at the home of cricket. He takes 5 for 32, thanks in some part to a questionable tactic from Dean Headley.
I had a shocking first test at Edgbaston. And the warm-up game against Worcester, I never felt in better rhythm. And then you go into the first test and deliver that, you know, it wasn't good. It really wasn't good. And having to work in between two tests, having to get myself ready and confident again, and got in that third test match, and I felt so much better. I felt really, really, you know, good. It just needed Dean Headley to fire me up a little bit. You know, and the rest of the slip cord and shouting, give it to him, you know. So it was, that's all I needed. I remember, got out, ran upstairs. I couldn't have put my bowling boots on quicker. I was so revved up, and there was a great crowd in that late evening. And I think it was James, he sort of fended one high off his armpit, and Mark Boucher was that was his debut tour. Took a great catch.
Big shout, and he's gone as well. Steve James joins Atherton on the long walk back to the pavilion. South Africa make early inroads once again. And Steve James' first test innings is over.
Gloved down the leg side. That's a great effort by Mark Boucher. Down the leg side, full stretch. And doesn't Alan Donald enjoy that?
And that was us off, you know, and you couldn't have asked for him, Dean Headley, to come in at night watchman either, because they were two down in no time. And so
why did he pick on you?
Well, he kept on bowling bumpers, and I sort of fended one off, and he walked down the pitch to me, and I just looked him straight in the eye, and I don't know, I said something to him which I can't remember now, but I was just so fired up. And the more I did that, the more that Alex Stewart and his men behind just kept on going, hey, Dino, just give it to him, give it to him. And I thought, well, you give it to me. That's fine. The adrenaline was pumping. But it was a great bowling performance, a collective bowling performance from everybody. That got us off to a really good start. We could have lost that first test in AH Bestang. If it didn't rain, I reckon we'd have probably come short there.
Yeah, it was a rain-affected test, and then that Lord's test. Jonty Rhodes and Hansi Cronier dug you out of a hole in the first innings because you were a few wickets down. Dominic Cork was swinging it around corners.
Yeah.
And then, so you posted 360 all out, but then that spell where you bowl England out for 110, and obviously that evening, that Friday evening, you had them 40 for three. You'd got the wicket of Steve James, I think. Pollock had picked up the other two.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful fifer, looking at it here, being a bit of a cricket geek. It's all Cork, Boucher, Bold, Donald.
Yeah.
Everything caught behind.
Yeah, I think Dean Headley was out soon in the morning, and then Nasser Hussain swung at one outside off stump, and he nicked it to Boucher.
Well taken. Beautiful catch by Mark Boucher. Hussain will be regretting playing that stroke. Tasuma's edged it. Boucher takes another catch. Donald's having a good morning. England are not.
It's actually quite a big edge. A little bit of away movement. But that probing around that off stump has paid off. Dean Headley has gone for two. It's 49 for five.
Huge appeal, Don. Ram Prakash doesn't want to go. Still doesn't want to go. Yes! Hit the glove and out. England are all out. Boucher takes a relatively simple catch. Fraser could do nothing about that stinging delivery from Donald, who takes his fifth wicket.
It was a good performance. I think a great team performance in that, because you're dead right. I mean, that could have turned real bad there if Cronier and Rhodes didn't play that well. And I think Jonty's knock there, the counter-attack from him personally, was because he turned that innings on its head. He just played so aggressively. Not to mention how well he ran between wickets. But he just seemed to... He was the only batter then who could hit guys like Cork off their lengths, that was a seriously good bit of batting in the context of the game, and how that panned out, that was valuable, really valuable.
So South Africa win the Lord's Test comfortably by 10 wickets and go one up in the series. The next test at Old Trafford's a draw, which frustrates Alan as England escape 9 down hanging on in their second innings. Next up is Trent Bridge. What unfolds is one of the greatest cricketing duels ever witnessed. England need 247 to win. They're 82 for 1 on the fourth day, with Mike Atherton and Nasser Hussain starting to build a partnership. South Africa need to do something.
I still see it now. I'm at fine leg, and I wave to Hansi, and I just said to him, I want to bowl now. I need to get on here now, you know. So I could see this, just there was a partnership developing here. He just got Butcher out, Pollock, and Hussain and Athers were in, and I thought I better get on here. And that first ball I bowled was like, you just feel so good. It just came out so well, and I felt a bit sort of stiffish, and I said, I'm coming around the wicket. So I said to Hansi, listen, I'm gonna give it a crack here. I'm gonna just give me the feel that I want for now and see how it goes. So I'm just gonna bowl two lengths. I'm just gonna go short and full. That's it. Just because at the moment nothing was happening.
So around the wicket then, two slips and a gully. Atherton really digging in. 27 not out. And here comes Donald and bowls round the wicket to him now, and it's just outside the off stump. Atherton's back and across in the crease. And Rhodes fields at cover point. 2 hours, 10 minutes now, this innings of Mike Atherton's.
And the next delivery round the wicket, fends it off, gloves it hard, and just, well, great catch by Mark Boucher. Low down to his right, takes an absolute blind, and I remember flying through, running through, but at the same time, I see Athers standing, and he's marking his thing, and I'm thinking, he's not walking. And then as I got to the slip cordon, everyone's just gone, you are what? And I turn around and I say, he's not giving him out. He's not giving him out. It was such a disbelief. It was just, it was so blatant. It was so, for everyone to see that he's just hit the absolute.
As Donald runs in from that far end and bowls a ball just short. Oh, that's gloved and Boucher's claiming the catch. They think it's out. Donald's running through. Atherton's staying there. They're looking towards umpire Dunn, who is unmoved. Now, it hit something, and Boucher took a very good catch and they had to come forward. They're still standing there, South Africans, glaring at the umpire. They shouldn't be doing that. But we'll have a look at a replay from round the wicket. It was dug in short. Atherton tried to fend it off.
What kicked off next was one of the best bits of cricket, the best bit of test cricket that I've ever been involved with. I think the War Twins was one other at Sydney, the second new ball that went similar way. But I think Atherton's duel was just something amazing. It could have gone any other way.
Here comes Donald again, round the wicket, and bowls a ball which is inside edge, and that's going to run away for four. A perfect answer as far as Mike Atherton and the crowd are concerned, but a horrible one as far as Donald's concerned. And he's looking there at Mike Atherton, who simply looks straight back at him, and Donald goes stalking back to his mark. 86 for one. It was a very good ball. It was a quick ball as well, and it ran away off the inside edge of Atherton's bat, just past his stumps, and away through fine leg for four. Well, if that doesn't stoke up Alan Donald, nothing will. And he's steaming at the moment.
We had a, everyone sees the cameras. You see the camera zoom into my mouth, and my mouth goes, come on. I must have said two swear words to him, and that's it. And he was saying that we spoke Afrikaans to them, which was just absolute rubbish. But if there were lots more cameras zooming in to that little circle there, and Hansie Cronje giving it to him every ball, and Daryl Cullinan and getting stuck in.
Well, he's got his hands on his hips. Atherton simply standing there as he does, and now he digs in again. What's Donald going to do? He's certainly waiting a moment. He's still waiting. He's looking at the ball. Now he's going to come in and bowl it. Two slips, a gully, down they go as Donald comes in round the wicket now and bowls to Atherton, a bouncer which flies over his shoulder. Boucher takes it. Donald follows through. A long stare at Mike Atherton. Atherton simply stares back. The crowd joining in. Well, it's a terrific contest, you have to say that. It was a good bouncer, that, a quick one. And Atherton played it very well indeed. And certainly Alan Donald there having a word with Atherton, who loves this situation. He simply stared back at him, didn't say a word.
But you have to take your hat off. I mean, he showed serious courage and composure under that pressure, because he could have gone one way or the other. And I think the thing that made it the worst was, then Hussain gets dropped, nicks it, and then Boucher goes and it just hits him so hard, just hits him gloves hard, and he pops up and drops out, and I couldn't help but just scream as loud as I could, not at Mark Boucher. It was just, you think you've put in so much energy and so much that you're trying to make things happen, and it's not.
Here's Donald bowls to Hussain, who's forward. Oh, he's dropped him. Well, Mark Boucher has gone to his right and has dropped the catch that may just lose this match for South Africa. We've been saying all along that he catches the ones that count, but sooner or later he was going to drop one that counts, and that might just be the one.
Now in comes Donald again, round the wicket and bowls to Atherton. That's short and fended away and down into the gully. Donald really is steaming here, and that was stopped in that position. There's more words from Alan Donald to Mike Atherton.
How frustrating was it that he just says
nothing.
Well, and that's just good batsmanship. That's just a guy that is so composed and in his bubble. And he knew, he says it often, he said, I just look in their eyes and I know they can stay as long as they want, but they'll have to turn back and they're going to have to try again. And that's true. It's very true. You can't stand there forever and tell him that he's a cheat. And it's not a cheat, really. It's just, you know, if you don't walk, you don't walk. And that's fine. And that's absolutely fine. I've got no problem with that. It's just that we, two men having a crack at each other that had so much pride of what is happening and the potential, what could happen, was a serious loss. And that certainly proved to be the knock that that got them there. We were pretty much blown away the next day, and it was just coming to read the last rites really the next day.
How did you keep your cool in the situation?
Well, I kept saying that, you know, from a coaching point of view now, it's that composure was I see that the ball after that, he was ready to face, and I was about to run in, and I took a step or two, and I came back, and I actually walked slower back, and I stood at the back of my mark, and I just took two huge breaths. And in that moment, I thought, right, Al, if you get really angry here, which you are now, you could then, this test match could be over tonight if you get that reckless. And so let's just stay aggressive, but stay aggressive in that channel, what we call the hot zone. Just give him absolutely nothing. Be aggressive, but just stay calm. Every single ball, when you walk back, just think about it. I think that really, you know, taught me a great deal about, and I use that a lot now in white ball cricket, composure, that composure, and even red ball cricket now. So I just thought, there's no need for me to now go and just spray it all over the show, because it has to count. Every ball has to count. So when it goes back in a length there, it's still challenging his defence, it's still challenging off stump. And I've got to make him play, because the nick is, it's every right now, within the next half hour, anything can happen. But it's how tight and disciplined and aggressive I stay now. So that really was a key for me. And Pollock at the other end did a great job, because he just kept slamming away. He just kept giving. It was crazy. It was NASA one end, happily sitting on his bat handle, and then
I don't blame him.
Then it was Atherton at the other. It was me and him just going at it. I almost forgot who was at the other end.
It was pure theatre. It's still one of the greatest sort of duels in Test cricket. Even just watching it back now, watching the tapes, it's amazing. But then after the day's play, or after the Test, you guys just shared a beer together. I mean,
yeah, he came upstairs and brought a few beers up, knocked on the door, and sat down on the step, and cheers, well bowled, well battered, and he gave me his right glove. Mm-hmm. Said, "There you go." He said, "You know, I was never going to walk. I just don't walk." And I said, "Seriously, whether you walk or not, I would. You know, a lot of people would have done the same thing. It was a brave thing to do, but also, you know, how we got through that whole onslaught was even more impressive, because he handled it so well." So well. He ducked well, took a few blows, mishooked one, but he was right there to the death, you know. So it was I think any young batsman wanted to learn about courage, I think that was it. And he was, well, he did it in Joburg,
yeah,
you know, where he batted for a day and a half, almost 2 days, bloody hell. It was he's done it again against South Africa. So the guy knows, he's got his own game plan, and he plays within that game plan, and he's just a tough man. You know, when you're in a scrap with Mike Atherton, you know this could take a while before you remove him.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Allen takes 33 wickets and is man of the series that summer, but still ends up on the losing side. England win the Trent Bridge Test and the final match at Headingley. It's a bitter pill to swallow for South Africa's strike bowler and leader of the pace attack, a role Allen's enjoyed since his early days, thanks to skipper Hansi Cronje.
It started a long time ago. It's when we played for Free State together, and he saw me as this... this guy who's I remember once we talked about leadership and explained to me what he wants from me, how he wants me to operate, and I made a very bad comment once. It was a throwaway comment, really. We were in New Zealand and we played on a glued pitch at Eden Park, the rugby ground. And I got into the tea time on the fourth afternoon, and I just was on the floor, and I just said, you know, this pitch is very flat. but in a very sarcastic manner. And he didn't speak to me for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Simply because he doesn't like that sort of thing from his leadership group. He didn't expect that from me. And when I said it, immediately I went ice cold. I thought, oh no, that was stupid. And well, instead of me just going, sorry about that, I didn't say a word. So I was in these good books for 2 weeks, but we eventually sorted it out. But that's what he expected from these senior players. That's where, and that's where Bob Woolmer was the great inventor as a coach, and Hansi was the great communicator. And that's what was his great strength. Hansi Cronje knew exactly what he could get out of his group of people that he works with. It was with every day. So he didn't say much on the field. Didn't say much. You just knew what he wanted, and he loved bowlers going, give me the ball.
Yeah,
he really enjoyed that. If you ever gut feel, Just say you want a ball. And you just knew he's going to ask you some point, so let's get that ball and go.
We've kind of come on naturally now to talk about Hansi Cronje. Obviously in this podcast we've talked about 94, that 5-wicket haul at Lords, 98, your relationship with Nelson Mandela, growing up in Bloemfontein, coming to England, coming to Warwickshire, that fantastic period you had there. One figure when I was sort of doing my research, doing my notes, that came up time and time again is Hansi Cronje. You grew up with him. You played in the backyard with him. Sitting here now, you talk about him as a great captain. However, the sad side of all that is he will be remembered ultimately, or is remembered, for the match-fixing saga which tainted his career. How did you feel when you heard about that at the time?
Well, first of all, I thought it was the biggest prank ever. I was over here, and South Africa were just about to play against Australia in 3 ODIs to see who's going to be the number one team in the world. So they played 3 there in Melbourne and 3 in South Africa and Durban. And I heard that it was something had come up. And I phoned his brother immediately. And I said to France, listen, he was in the car with him, driving him to the hotel. And he said, Al, don't worry about it. It's only just a rumor, big rumor. And Dr. Bach actually tells a great story. He said he received a call at 2 a.m. in the morning from Hansi saying that, look, Doc, I must come clean. I must tell you the story. So I think the next day there was a press conference that he's admitted to taking money from bookmakers, and that's as much as that was said then. It was yes, the allegations were match fixing, but also he said he only took money from bookmakers. But yeah, when it came out, I was the angriest man in the world because you know, we were great buddies. He wasn't my brother really. I mean, the brother I never had. We grew up, this high in the back garden playing rugby test matches with his dad being the referee and cricket and all sorts. So when that came out, I felt extremely let down, and so did the rest of the group that played under him. The rest was really history, and how he was dealt with was, I thought, in certain circumstances that Cricket South Africa, or CSA as they, United Cricket Board back in the day as they were called, had him where they wanted him, because Hansi stood up for a lot for the team behind closed doors. And Cricket South Africa didn't quite like that sort of power. But, he got a life ban and went to court and had to defend himself. And, but a long story short, I don't think I would have ever forgiven myself if I didn't have the opportunity to speak with him in Bloom. So he phoned me. So after 12 months, he phoned me and said, we need to talk. So he flew down from Cape Town and we sat for 5 hours in my bar at home, where we just chatted about all the stuff, and he absolutely 100% said to me that he never fixed a match. It was easy money, it was greedy money. So yeah. Which was he just got sucked into that dark world and just thought it's all right to do this sort of thing. But
did you forgive him at that sort of, in that 5 hour conversation? Not therapeutic, but was it, there's a sense of,
I just kept asking why.
Yeah,
why
did he have answers for you?
Or? He just said, it was easy.
Yeah,
it was easy to do it, and it was easy to take the money. But he said that he never ever fixed a match for South Africa. He did not fix a match. Your mind starts to race about other things that you might have been involved in. You think, well, oof, what about that game or that game? That's only speculation back in those days. I was fine with that. And he explained himself. And look, there wasn't a dry eye in that 5 hours, I can tell you that much. He's, as I said, often referred to him as my brother. I never almost called him Hansi. I still called him my brother. He was a serious captain. He was the best I've ever played under. And he showed that in Sydney in 93, 94, when he took over from Kepler having a broken thumb. He handled a situation like he was 50 test matches in.
Yeah.
That's how good he was. And you just hear him speak and his calmness, and he was born to be a captain, absolutely born. And he was also a hell of a rugby player, eighth man or number six, seven. He was a big bloke, and he was one of those guys that during a test, and if we had If we had bowled the day before, or had a great batting day, and he starts putting spikes on after the day's play, you know where that's going. That's going out there to do fitness, you know. And he didn't have to ask people. They just followed him. And that's how powerful he was. You know, that's how impactful he was in terms of, all right, he's going to do some shuttles. Anyone keen? He didn't even ask that. So the whole team was, oh, okay, spikes on. Here we go. And he'll just say, right, who's going to call the number? 40? 40 of these, and off you go.
You should have said a lower number.
Someone always had to shout 40 because 20 was never going to make the cut.
Right. And it's 16 years ago this year that Hansi Cronje tragically passed away in that plane crash. Just to finish on, I guess you still miss him so much.
Yeah. I mean, there's not many days that we go without, you know, because I'm very close friends, obviously. I've known his sister for many years, and then his brother lives not far from us in Cape Town. So I see them a lot. So, you know, his dad is not so well. He's been ill for a long time, and so he's not going too well there. But yeah, I mean, he'll always be missed. And I think a lot of South Africans now, the odd one would come out and say a stupid comment. But a lot of people still have that great admiration for what he did. He was that impactful. He always, whatever he said came over so strongly and powerfully. You know, so yeah, he will be forever missed, absolutely.
And I was just looking at some of the stats quickly, and except for Dennis Lilly, who played 70 test matches, he took 355 wickets. You took 330 in 72 tests. Basically, behind Dennis Lilly, on that fewer amount of tests, you're the second top wicket taker. Everyone else who's taken more test wickets than you has played at least 81 test matches or more. You truly are one of the great fast bowlers. Did the little boy in Bloemfontein know that?
No. That's actually a very good question, because I've been asked that a lot. Did you know that you're going to become this kind of? And the answer is no. I never dreamt about it. Thank goodness there wasn't too many distractions. And I'm not saying living in Bloem. I'm just saying there were genuinely not too many things in my cricket career that distracted me from focusing on what I need to do.
Do you mean things like booze, women, drugs, all that kind of stuff? Or?
No.
Because there are those trappings along the way.
Yeah, they are. But I think the distraction, what I'm talking about, was really the overuse of goal setting. That was, for me, was the big thing. And I spoke to a guy called Alan Jones in Australia way back, and we spoke about leadership, and that is the best advice he could have ever given me, was when he was working with the Wallaby team at that point, and he said to me, it was Kepler's big friend, and he said to me, he asked me about my goal setting, and I said, well, this year, and he said, okay, stop right there. So have you ever thought about waking up in the morning and saying, have you ever planned your day? I said, not really. He said, well, you should start looking into that maybe. You know, start looking into how you want to structure your practice today. What do you want out of your practice today? So because leaders are born on the training ground, not what they do out there in competition. That will generally take care of itself. And when your career is over, people will say, wow, he was a great leader. But he said, that stuff happens out there on the training ground. And that's what I coach today. It's so true. It's so, so true. And the distractions that I'm talking about is the goal setting. And that, for me, was so good. I kept it tight, compact. It's about, Alan Donald, what are you about today? How are you going to change? How can you impact the day today with a ball?
It's almost like a kind of form of mindfulness, it's just being in that moment.
Correct.
Did you do, I mean, to use that analogy, talking to you now, it's almost like an actor, you practice your lines and then you go on the stage and then you deliver. Is that how you played your cricket?
Correct. Just like that. Just like that. But for me, was, and Hans, the great Eddie Barlow was our coach in the early 90s. And he asked me this question one day, and I'm really bowling well, I'm bowling quickly, and I rocked up there, and I'm bowling off like 10 paces, and he stopped me right in my tracks, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just having a little bowl." He said, "No, what are you doing?" I'm not quite sure where he's going with this, but I said, "I'm not," and I genuinely asked him, I said, "I'm not sure." He said, "Oh, okay. So you're bowling at 140 odd. Do you understand why that's happening?" And I quit immediately. The lights went on, and that's where he demanded. He was the first coach that I played under that demanded practicing at high intensity, not for too long, but at high intensity, and understanding when you're in good form why it's happening. So another great lesson in life that sort of, you know, kicked me hard, and that's exactly what I'm sort of passing on today. And I think that, and he called it, he said it, his first thing he wrote was the training ground culture, and I loved it. I think it was, and that's where Cronier, who was captain of Free State, just took that on board, and that's how we trained. It was hostile, it wasn't a nice place to come, as you know, if you're a batsman walking away from there, it was, wow, that was tough.
And do you still turn your arm over ever today? Have you played any club cricket?
No, I'm genuinely sore. I've got a right knee, two ankles that are not good. So I throw a lot with the sidearm and slings, and that's me. But it's genuinely painful. I'd rather stay away from that.
Well, thank goodness for any club cricketers that would turn up on a Saturday and see Alan Donald marking out his run. Well, thank you so much for your time today and coming on the Lord's Cricket Podcast. It's been entertaining. It was a pleasure to watch you. You were a great player and a great entertainer. So thank you for
that. Thank you very much for having me. Cheers, Will.
Well, you've been listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast with the stories from the home of cricket and the people that made them. That was Alan Donald on a couple of special performances here at Lord's, and also some amazing memories from a phenomenal career, and with some emotional moments too. What an absolute pleasure that was to sit down with Alan Donald. He's someone you don't really hear much from these days in the media because he tends to do a lot of coaching. He's currently at Kent. It was just amazing, really, to catch up with a childhood hero of mine and be in a room with him, and him to tell that Donald v. Atherton duel all over again and live it like it was yesterday. He still, you could see in his face, and I hope you can hear, just even now he's angry that Donald didn't go off the pitch or wasn't given out. He doesn't blame him for not walking, but it was out, and it annoys him. So I really do hope you enjoyed that podcast. Please do give the show a rating. It helps to get the podcast out there. Tell people about the podcast. If you've got friends who are cricket fans, then let them know it's available. We've got three more in this series to come. Also, subscribe to the podcast. So hopefully, once this series is done, we'll be making a fresh one. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Home of Cricket. Or follow me personally. I'm at Will Rowe 2. You can also contact the show by email on podcast@mcc.org.uk. Also, a massive thanks to the BBC, Sky Cricket and ECB for the commentary clips there. That was really special, listening back to Jonathan Agnew describing that duel with Michael Atherton. It really is one of the most special moments in all sport, I think. I know I've sort of banged on about it, but it really was electrifying. It was pure theatre. It was brilliant. Right, next week's episode is with Graham Onions. His Lord's story is one of childhood dreams. A Test fiver on debut here in the summer of 2009. He then also goes on to be part of England's Ashes winning summer. that year in 09. But Onion's career doesn't live up to the promise that it showed back then. For me, he's probably the most unlucky England cricketer of his generation, only playing 9 Test matches. I discuss all that plus plenty more in an honest and frank conversation, actually, with a player affectionately known as Bunny Onions. We caught up recently. He's now plying his trade at Lancashire, still going strong, and still a Durham man through and through. So that's next week's Lords Cricket Podcast, which is out next Monday with Graham Onions. Once again, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.